Hello, welcome to The Wire, where you can get independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station, wherever you are, right around Australia. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on The Wire today...
To some extent, the current electoral race is looking like, you know, two big engines, each with a sidecar, so to speak.
New Zealand will have a new Prime Minister in Chris Hipkins as the new Labor leader following the resignation of Jacinda Ardern. We take a look at what this will mean for the upcoming elections in New Zealand. Also coming up on the program...
Wuthering Heights is so sort of passionate, and there's this, you know, great love story, so to speak, between Cathy and Heathcliff, although I would argue that Wuthering Heights isn't a love story.
We also take a look at a new movie entitled Emily, focusing on the life of Emily Bronte, the sister who wrote Wuthering Heights. All of the Bronte sisters were talented but quite different in personality, and we look at why Emily is so intriguing. But first, Queensland's Department of Education recently announced that they would be banning access to artificial intelligence software, including ChatGPT, in public schools across the state. The announcement comes after New South Wales announced similar plans to restrict students' access to ChatGPT, citing concerns the software could be used for cheating on assessments. But why are experts and educators so worried about ChatGPT, and what could it be used for? Matthew Van Wyk asked Dr. Vitimir Kovanovic, a senior lecturer in education futures at the University of South Australia, what ChatGPT actually is.
So it is an online chatting tool that actually allows anybody to access very powerful textual AI models that can provide really kind of question and answer functionality to all kinds of things. And what the system actually does, it just generates the next word, the next probable word in the sequence. But, for example, United States, all probably the next one to predict will be America, right? But actually, if you sequence the words like a question or any form of instruction, actually it will predict the response. So almost like what we are currently using it as question-answer system is almost like a side functionality of a system that was originally intended just to predict the sequence of words, like an autocomplete. Like imagine you're pressing the autocomplete on your phone and every second word, every next word that comes out.
So how might school students use it then?
So basically what the students will do then is they will copy and paste the assignment instructions. And then the system will continue predicting the word, but these words will be actually the answer to the question. Because in the context of what is the most probable answer for this kind of input, well, you know, if you write a question, the system will continue with the response to the question. So you could, the essay was, you know, write the critical differences between pro-abortion versus against abortion views and justify that, you know. If student copies a like assignment like that in the ChatGPT window, the system will continue and write a response using all the data from the internet. And which is really powerful is the text won't be plagiarized from a specific source or anything like that. The system will write the response that actually in most cases is very, very meaningful and very, very good. There have been many systems many tests been done with this platform. It was able to pass business school exams in, you know, MBA examinations, medical school examinations, and things like that. So it's very, very powerful.
So how might it then impact students' education? Would it, like, affect the way they communicate or their critical thinking skills or something like that?
So basically it will undermine the current assessment practices. So the big thing was at the moment there is a big, big chunk of student assessments and grades being given for things the students write. And I mean, obviously, always there was a question of how much parents are helping or, you know, other friends and things like that. But now everybody has next to them a very powerful system that can help them generate the response to, you know, homework assignment. And so that will really impact the quality of our assessment. Now everybody will be able to write on a, you know, maybe not on a, you know, highest possible grade, but on a decent grade. So that's really going to impact, you know, that undermines the whole point of the assessment.
Some universities, especially in the Group of Eight in Australia and elsewhere, including other educational districts in the world, have announced changes to, like, the academic integrity policies, including, you know, classifying the use of AI in assignments as cheating, as well as possibly moving towards more in-person supervision and pen and paper assessments. Is this enough to address the issues AI might pose in the classroom, and is there anything else that can be done?
So, well, it's a very temporary... Very temporary fix. I mean, in a sense, yes, you can change the policies, that's fine, but the system will be very hard to detect. And it will be a game and, you know, cat and mouse. You will develop a system to detect. There will be another system that will be developed to obscure that. So moving to pen and paper, yeah, sure, you can do that, but that's not really the point. Why would we do that? I see the reason in a short term. Our current assessments are all based on the fact that students will be writing responses to written assignments. And with something like ChatGPT shows up out of nowhere, yeah, and that there is a problem. But in the long term, moving to pen and paper is I think, is a horrible idea, and it's actually very counterproductive because they're going to do it in the workplace. Everybody will be using it in the workplace. So what's then the point? Why we are they going to be using pen and paper in the workplace? Far less than ChatGPT. So, I mean, it's really not fair to the students to do that. We need to find a way to meaningfully integrate ChatGPT into our assignments and assessments and everything we do. I mean, there is other ways than giving students to write an essay. There are other ways to do an assessment. And I mean, the field of research and assessment, there is other things you can do there.
Dr. Vitimir Kovanovich, Senior Lecturer in Education Futures at the University of South Australia, speaking there with Matthew Van Wyk.
After a hard day out in the paddock, I like to catch up with The Wire. Find out what's going on around this big country.
The Wire, bringing you the stories from all around Australia.
New Zealanders were rocked last week to find out that Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern would be stepping down. Several contenders appear to be in the mix, but Labor appears to be making a seamless transition to former 44-year-old Education Minister Chris Hipkins. I asked Dr. Grant Duncan from Massey University in New Zealand that now that he was about to become Prime Minister, how would Chris Hipkins sell himself to the electorate given the looming elections?
Well, he's quite a different personality from Jacinda Ardern and is, I don't think, going to be any of the kind of international recognition and celebrity that Ardern generated. Nonetheless, if you look back to their maiden speeches in the House, you know, they both entered the House in 2008, and I think you know, going back to those sort of idealistic moments when a new politician gets a chance to state their values and aspirations, although they use different words, they actually started out, I think, with very similar Labour social democratic values. So in some senses, they come from a very similar kind of place about wanting to have a more compassionate society and so forth, solid social democratic values. So he's hardworking, dependable, and I think politically very pragmatic. So although, like Jacinda Ardern, you know, they both shared those social democratic values, my impression so far is that Hipkins really has got a clear focus on what the Labour Party needs to do to try to be restored to government after the next election.
The Nationals appear to be ahead in the polls at the moment. Mm-hmm. What is this? Why is this happening? Is it because the economy is front and centre in people's minds?
To some extent, leadership or change of leadership in National. Some disillusionment among some people with Ardern's leadership and also some policy and economic dissatisfaction among the public.
And what about minor parties? They've had quite a big effect in New Zealand politics in the past, although not so much in the last election, I believe. But are they going to play a bigger part in this election coming up in October?
Oh, definitely, yes. So to some extent, the current electoral race is looking like, you know, two big engines, each with a sidecar, so to speak. So you've got essentially a National ACT Party coalition on one side, and the ACT Party is more libertarian on the other, you've got Labor and the Greens. And so those are your two probable main coalitions. We don't know at this stage whether New Zealand First will be successful in making it back into Parliament, but I wouldn't write them off necessarily at this stage.
And that's Winston Peters,
right,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think he's been written off so many times and he keeps bouncing back, so yeah. You've really got to be a bit careful with him, haven't you?
Absolutely. Yeah, well put.
Yes. So, you know, he again could be kingmaker if things go his way.
That's possible, yeah.
What do you think about Christopher Luxon? Is he becoming, you know, perhaps a bit more familiar to voters and a bit more attractive now that Jacinda Ardern's no longer in the picture?
We'll have to wait and see. But certainly, one of the paradoxical things is that, on the one hand, National was leading Labor in the polls up until the most recent polls in January, but Christopher Luxon wasn't leading in the preferred Prime Minister poll. He was still lagging behind Jacinda Ardern in preferred Prime Minister. Yeah, probably he's not performing for National as well as they would have liked. Certainly, I think he's had plenty of time for New Zealanders to come are familiar with him, but just from a sort of anecdotal vox pop point of view, I don't hear people really raving about the guy, put it that way.
And I suppose lastly, with the New Zealand system of elections, what are the big hurdles that have to be overcome by the major parties?
I think we can be fairly confident that neither of the two major parties is going to be able to govern alone like Labor is at the moment. I really don't think that's very likely. So come the election night in New Zealand, often there's a bit of a wait while we see, first of all, what the final results actually are. So that can take 2 weeks till we see the final result, which might make a bit of a change to some seating arrangements. And then there are potentially quite lengthy government formation negotiations while different coalitions seek some kind of arrangement so that they can get the majority in the House. But yeah, on election night, I would imagine we won't necessarily have a clear result. And so minor parties, particularly the Māori Party, which will probably get 2 or 3 seats, and possibly New Zealand First, if they can make it over the 5% threshold, may have a role. So I think it's going to be a close race.
Dr. Grant Duncan, Associate Professor of School, People, Environment and Planning at Massey University, and speaking with me there. I'm Roderick Chambers, and you're listening to The Wire, around Australia, on the Community Radio Network. There's growing concern about commercial exploitation of Australia's national parks and state reserves. Ahead of the March state election, the New South Wales government appears to be rushing a proposal through to grant a 20-year lease to a major tourism operator in the Gardens of Stone Conservation Area north of Lithgow. Spokesperson for Wilderness Australia Keith Muir tells Wendy Frew what the risks are for the Gardens of Stone.
The Gardens of Stone is probably the most beautiful area of the Greater Blue Mountains. It has spectacular geodiversity, beautiful rock formations, and these are called pagodas. And these are sort of like stone temples or little stone villages like Angkor Wat. And in amongst that is very rare plants, which make it biodiverse as well as geodiverse. And then you have beautiful long cliff lines, slot canyons, windblown sand dunes that are up on the top of a plateau. It is spectacular. It's not a fun park. It doesn't need anything other than nature to bring people to it.
Tell me what the government's actually proposing in the Gardens of Stone Conservation Area. What are these additional structures and things that they want to put in?
There's 4 accommodation resorts of some sort. We don't know exactly what they'll be. They're supposed to be associated with a walking track, but they've also got vehicular access. So we are not confident that they just won't become independent accommodation facilities in the park. and grow like Topsy over a period of years, just like what has happened in Kosciuszko National Park, where you now have a couple of towns. And then they've got an amusement theme park, but it's like putting fun rides on the Three Sisters.
Why are you concerned about the way the government has handled these ideas?
The governance of this process is an absolute schmozzle. You've got these two leases, one for four accommodation facilities or resorts and another for a theme park, but no information on either of those. The only information is the names of the company and where these things are going to occur and that the leases will run for 20 years. So how can the public comment on that? But yet it's been out for public comment. So the government department involved with all this stuff to do with regulation is promoting the attraction as well. And they're also the regulatory authority for the visitation and for the delivery of these facilities. And it's all going to be subsidised to the tune of $50 million from the government. The developer's going to get a subsidy. There's this sort of totally blurred arrangement where the development controlling agency is also promoting the thing that's going to be developed.
When were people allowed to make comments about the leases?
The exhibition period started on the 21st of December and it ended on the 18th of January. So the public didn't have much of a chance to comment because not only was there no information, they were on holidays at the same time. And it's obviously being driven by a real wish to approve all this in a great hurry, presumably to get it all done before the election so that there can be a bit of electoral flag waving and saying, aren't we clever, look what we've done.
What would you like to see the government do from this point on? Or what would you like perhaps the Labor opposition to say about this?
The process should go to an inquiry to review what has actually happened. The Labor Party should come out and oppose these leases and they should say that they support nature-based tourism as they always have and to seek to build a better tourism industry for Lithgow, which is beside the park and complements the park and works with the park so that nature is protected and interpreted. But I'm just worried that the government's going to waste $50 million spending it on these facilities instead of on the broader park, which needs interpretation, it needs walking tracks, it needs campgrounds and so on. But you can't do that and prop up these big facilities that a commercial operator is going to run. The visitors will go to these facilities, not to Lithgow, and the money won't come to the town. So let's have an inquiry. Let's have a discussion about this. Let's pull it all apart and see how we can do things better.
Keith Muir from Wilderness Australia speaking there with Wendy Frew.
Whenever I want to catch up with current affairs in Australia, I head to thewire.org.au or I follow them on Twitter. I just search for The Wire Radio, all one word. And yes, they're on Facebook too.
Frances O'Connor's new film, Emily, chronicles a take on the life of Emily Bronte, the famous sister who wrote the Victorian Gothic novel Wuthering Heights. Emily was the most reclusive sister, but also wrote the passionate bestseller which still intrigues many today. I asked Dr. Stephanie Russo from the Department of Media, Communications, Creative Arts, Languages and Literature at Macquarie University why people are so interested in the lives of the brilliant Bronte sisters.
The Bronte sisters are incredibly interesting in their own right, which is why people are making or have been making biopics about them as well as adaptations of their novels. In terms of how they came to be the writers that they are, I guess they are really highly influenced by their own reading. So they were reading a lot of Gothic novels. They were reading really widely themselves. And they were really interested in writing from a very early age. So when they were really young, growing up together, they would write stories set in imaginary worlds. And they were often highly flecked with Gothic themes and influences. So they had a really long, I think, literary apprenticeship. So even though, if you read the biography of their lives, Charlotte, you know, gets around a little bit, but Emily mostly lives at home and doesn't, she goes to Belgium for a while, but she doesn't really travel all that much or you know, have a very exciting life on paper. But I think they had really highly developed imaginations and really a really long literary apprenticeship, I guess.
Were there great scandals in their lives as well?
I don't think there were huge scandals, especially not in Emily's life. Emily, the romance that she's given in the film is entirely invented. In terms of the scandals in Charlotte's life, Charlotte did fall in love with her married, the sort of head of the school at which she worked. That seems to have led nowhere. But I think he was very aware of this, and she did write some sort of really impassioned letters to him. I think that's the closest you can get to an actual scandal in their lives. But, I mean, writing in itself, I guess, was scandalous, and certainly the kinds of writing that the Brontes did was scandalous because it wasn't decorous, it was passionate, it was quite wild, it was, you know, full of exciting things, I guess. And so I think that this, the real scandal of their lives lies in the things that they wrote about. So while Charlotte had a kind of active social life, Emily is very internal. So when you are making a biopic about her life, you do inevitably have to invent romance for her, so to speak.
But the juxtaposition between what's obviously going on in her mind and what's actually going on in her world is what's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's remarkable that, you know, this woman who mostly kept to herself, mostly interacted only with her family and mostly, you know, stayed at home, has this rich imagination. And I think that's why we are compelled to revisit her story as well as obviously adaptations of her novel, because we want to figure out what inspired her to write. And I think that's why people invent romances for her, because Wuthering Heights is so sort of passionate, and there's this, you know, great love story, so to speak, between Kathy and Heathcliff, although I would argue that Wuthering Heights isn't a love story. But anyway, because there's such passion and kind of and drama in the novels, I think people have like looked to her life in order to sort of explain where it came from. And I think we do that more often with female writers than male writers. I think there's this assumption that female writers are always writing about their own experiences, whereas, you know, with Emily Brontë, it seems clear that this is a product of her imagination rather than something that, you know, she experienced.
And so in this movie, Emily, what's something that we find out about her that perhaps we wouldn't have thought would have been part of her character?
Well, I think that what's really interesting about the film, I mean, so much of the film is invented, as I said. There's an invented romance that she has in the film with her father's curate, William Waitman. William Waitman is a real-life kind of acquaintance of the Brontë family. But if he did have a romance with anyone, it was potentially with Anne, her younger sister. So in terms of sheer facts...
Why do you say that? What is it about Anne?
There are a few references to a high regard that Anne had for William Waitman in letters and so forth. So we don't have any, you know, concrete evidence that there was, you know, a passionate love affair or anything like that. But, you know, if there was a kind of hint of romance between William and anyone, it was going to be Anne.
It sounds very Victorian when you say high regard.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, when I talk about this sort of stuff, I sort of lapse into Victorianism for some reason. But in terms of facts, I mean, you're not going to find out a lot of, you know, uncovered historical facts because it is an invented story. However, what I found really compelling and I think is quite true is that Emily Brontë is represented in this film as very strange and almost incapable of social interaction. So you see her at various times go away from home and go to school with Charlotte, which did happen, but she's so averse to social interactions and so introverted that she almost falls apart when she is away from home. And I think that is quite true. And I think that the film does a really good job of capturing her very strange, very unusual, very distinct personality, insofar as we know what her personality is. Where the film's strength lies is in this portrait of this odd genius. And I think that that is what I found most compelling about the film.
Dr. Stephanie Russo, Associate Professor of Literature in the Department of Media, Communications, Creative Arts, Languages and Literature at Macquarie University, and speaking with me there. And that's it for The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au or subscribe to our podcasts. Just look for The Wire Radio. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2 SER 107.3 here in Sydney and broadcast around the nation on the Community Radio Network. In Sydney, The Wire is produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so do tune in again then. I'm Roderick Chambers. Do stay well and thanks for your company.